I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome to Radio Times.
Thank you, Mr. President. Dan Rather with CBS News. President, are you running for something? No, sir, Mr. President, are you?
That was Dan Rather sparring with President Nixon in 1974 at the National Association of Broadcasters annual convention. Rather was known for his confrontational approach to interviews in his many years at CBS as a reporter and anchor and managing editor of the CBS Evening News. He and other news anchors on the two other TV networks wielded a lot of influence for many years before there was social media and the advent of cable news. Dan Rather founded and heads up an independent production company called News and Guts with a big following on Facebook. He's also written a new book with Elliot Kirshner, and it's titled What Unites Us, Reflections on Patriotism. Dan Rather joins us on Radio Times, and nice to have you with us on
the
radio.
Thank you very much.
Are you worried about America? And I have to say, part of this book is hopeful, but there are a number of caveats.
I am worried about America, and I appreciate your noting that the book, one reason I wrote it, is filled with hope and optimism. I'm an optimist by nature and by experience. However, I recognize, and I think most Americans somewhere down deep inside themselves recognize, this is a perilous time for the country. We've been through perilous times before. The 1960s were a very divisive time. Our great and tragic Civil War, perhaps our most divisive moment. But this is not normal, what we're going through now. This is in many ways unique. There is an effort by the national leadership in many ways to convince us that to have this tone in the presidency, to have the kind of divisive remarks emanating from the president himself is, quote, normal. And I think it's very important to underscore, italicize, this is not normal. But I want to make clear that the spirit of the book, What Unites Us, this is not a screed about the Trump administration. In fact, President Trump is not even mentioned. And I'd like to believe, I do believe, that even the most hardcore Trump supporters, other than those who are members of the Ku Klux Klan or some openly bigoted outfit, can find something in this book that will start a conversation about patriotism. What is patriotism in the second decade of the 21st century? I'm having this conversation with myself, and I hope that What Unites Us will spark a conversation among rank-and-file Americans.
Well, I had a question about patriotism, because I think for some people it means my country right or wrong, or it means nationalism, or it means you do not kneel during the national anthem. What do you mean by patriotism?
Well, first of all, I go to the dictionary definition, and I recommend that anyone who's a little bit confused about the difference between patriotism and nationalism go to the dictionary. Patriotism and nationalism can overlap, but patriotism to me, and I gently try to suggest this in the book, patriotism, part of the core of it is a certain humility. An attitude of, I love my country deeply, I care about what happens to my country, but I recognize that we're not perfect, that the American story as laid out in the Constitution was seeking always a more perfect union. It's love of country, but tempered with humility, that listens to other voices in around the world. Nationalism is more of a chest beating, my country right or wrong, we're the greatest. And extreme nationalism, we know from our history that extreme nationalism can lead to very dire results. For example, economic nationalism during the 1920s led to the Great Depression. Racial nationalism, Aryan nationalism, led to Adolf Hitler. Now, we're not at that point, but we do need to recognize that by electing, by any reasonable analysis, an authoritarian regime whose instincts are authoritarianism. Authoritarianism can very easily lead to extreme nationalism, which could in turn lead to nativism, which then can descend into tribalism. And we know as Americans that if we ever just become a collection of tribes, then we're not the United States of America.
I was thinking about your life. You lived through the Depression, through World War II, through McCarthyism, the Vietnam War, Watergate, Iran-Contra, impeachment, 9/11, the list goes on and on. And obviously we survived all those crises, and I think in many cases we grew and even evolved from that, and hopefully we are a better country because of all of that. But do you think we are in a position to learn and evolve and grow from where we are today?
We certainly in a position to do that. The question is, are we going to do this? And I'm glad you ticked off that list, including the Red Scare of McCarthyism and a long list of things. You know, we Americans, to repeat, we're not perfect. We know that. We're always,
do we know that?
Well, I think we do somewhere deep within our soul, but in the havoc of today's headlines and the chaos and, yes, even dysfunction, which has marked many aspects of this present administration, it's easy to forget then. But one of the things we're really good at in America is being steady. Now, we're in an unsteady period now, as we were during the 1960s, for example, with divisions over the Vietnam War. But there is a chapter in What Unites Us, and one of the things that unites us is our steadiness. That Americans, we can go through a period of being rocked, but you know, coming out of World War II, we were steady. We understood that everything was on the table. Either we were going to win the war or we were going to be speaking Japanese and German. And we were steady through that. So there's a steadiness in the American character. And part of the plea, and it is a plea in What Unites Us, is just to remember that's what's gotten us through so often in the past. And it can get us through now, but not. It won't get us through just thinking about it. You have to act, including going to the polls and vote.
Well, you talk about growing up in East Texas, and your family was poor, I think, like a lot of other people. But you talk about your father, and one of the things that he would say was, steady, just hold steady, do what you can. I mean, these were words he said when you were a young boy growing up. And I'm thinking of the word that ends this book, which is the word courage, something you said at least for a short time when you were the host of the CBS Evening News, until I don't know whether you were shamed out of not saying that. But is courage the word we need to think about today?
Well, certainly one of the words we need to think about for two reasons. First of all, courage, by my shot from horseback definition, is being afraid but going ahead. And courage was my father's favorite word. Not that he thought that he had it in abundance, but it was an aspiration. And nationally, as a society, as a people, yes, we need as an aspiration courage, particularly during these days, in this period right now, and then as individuals we need it. Because we're aware, again, we don't always think of it, but as some great philosopher, I can't call his name right at the moment, once said that of the virtues, courage is the most important because the others flow from courage. Virtues such as empathy frequently flow from courage. So I like the word. It's not that I've ever been a courageous person, but I like the word because it's an aspiration, and I do, again, gently suggest in What Unites Us, we think about courage, that courage is one of the things that has united us.
You have a chapter on interviewing Medgar Evers. I mean, is he the definition of courage?
Absolutely, and I think about Medgar Evers very often, and for those viewers who don't remember who he was or were not alive during the time, he was a principal advocate for Dr. Martin Luther King and the Civil Rights Movement in Mississippi in the early 1960s. And that's when I met him, when I was covering Dr. King for CBS News, and I met Medgar Evers in Mississippi. And a detail in What Unites Us, that scene where he was trying to get voting rights. This is before the Voting Rights Act of mid-1960s was passed. And I'll never forget, he showed up at a voting place leading some very reluctant and fearful for a reason, African-Americans, and saying to the precinct head, I'm here with these people, they're qualified to vote, I'd like for them to vote, and being turned away in no uncertain terms and threatening. And, of course, Medgar Evers was later assassinated by a cowardly murderer who hid in the reeds across from his home and shot him dead in front of his wife and children.
Yeah. We need more courage today, people like
Absolutely.
Medgar Evers.
We need more courage to do the right thing. Just do the right thing. And sometimes it takes courage. For example, sometimes the right thing is to dissent, which is another one of the virtues as a country. We tend to forget it. And there are always people who want to make dissent appear to be unpatriotic. You dissent, you're unpatriotic. Time after time we've seen that. In the 19th century, for example, anyone who advocated for women's right to vote, I mean, now we can sort of say, my God, what could we be thinking? But those women suffragettes in the 19th century were accused of being unpatriotic, being radical, being extremist, being socialist, communist, bomb-throwing Bolsheviks, all kinds of things. But dissent is so important to our national being. I do have a chapter about it in the book.
Yes, you do. As I mentioned, you grew up in East Texas. You describe your parents as avid newspaper readers. What led to you becoming a journalist?
I think because my parents were avid newspaper readers.
Truly.
I've never known. You know, I'm one of the lucky ones that I've always known what I wanted to do. I dreamed of being a reporter. In my time and place, Texas, during the Depression, being a reporter meant being a newspaper reporter. I think that must have come from the fact that my parents, while neither one had finished high school, I recognize that in today's environment, that strikes people as strange, but it was not unusual in that time and place. But they had a thirst for knowledge, and my father would describe newspapers as the poor man's university.
Oh, wow. So, well, I like that.
My parents they read newspapers, they discussed what's in the newspapers, and I think as a very young child, I must have said, well, if my parents spend as much time with newspapers, it must be important, and that's what got me into journalism.
You also had rheumatic fever as a child, bedridden for a while, and this is a radio show, so you used to listen to Edward R. Murrow on the radio, right?
That's true, and having rheumatic fever, while it was terrible for me at the time, was transformative for me. I had it in two distinct periods between the ages of 10 and the end of 14,
really?
In which I was bedridden, which is a certain terror for a child. I'm not being overly dramatic about it, but there was no known cure at the time. There is now. And it was every mother's nightmare, second only to polio. And the doctor's counsel was, we don't know how to cure it. All you can do, the best you can do, is put him to bed and have him move as little as possible. That made me bedridden for two long periods as a child, and the radio was my constant companion. Mm-hmm. And that's when I, you know, got attached to Edward R. Murrow and Eric Severide and Charles Collingwood, the great CBS News correspondents, because to me, there in bed, trying to stay as still as I could, the radio, they were reporting from faraway places with strange-sounding names, having a great adventure, and doing important work. And I was mesmerized by it.
That is Dan Rather, our guest in this hour of Radio Times. He's co-authored a new book with Elliot Kirshner. It's called What Unites Us, Reflections on Patriotism. Spent many years at CBS as a reporter, also anchor and managing editor of the CBS Evening News. Also hosted interviews on 60 Minutes and Dan Rather Reports. It goes on and on and on. To join us, 1-888-477-9499. Much more to talk about after this very short break. We'll be right back. I'm Marty Moscowane here on Radio Times in Philadelphia, WHYY, talking with Dan Rather. Let me play a clip from a live interview that Dan Rather did with then Vice President George Herbert Walker Bush, and this is 1988.
I don't want to be argumentative, Mr. Vice President.
You do, Dan.
No,
this is not a
no,
great
sir,
night because I want to talk about why I want to be president, why those 41% of the people are supporting me.
And Mr. Vice President, these questions are
fair to judge a whole career. It's not fair to judge my whole career by a rehash on Iran. How would you like it if I judge your career by those 7 minutes when you walked off the set in New York?
Well,
now, would you like that?
Mr. Vice President,
I have respect for you, but I don't have respect for what you're doing here tonight.
Mr. Vice President, I think you'll agree that your qualification for president and what kind of leadership you'd bring to the country, what kind of government you'd have, what kind
exactly.
of people to have around him is much more important than what you just referred to. I'd be happy
well,
to hold
I want to be
that.
Judged on the whole record.
Well,
and you're not
and I'm
me
trying
an
to set the record straight.
You invited me to come here to talk about, I thought, the whole record.
I want you to talk about the record. You sat in a meeting with George Shultz.
Yes.
He got apoplectic
an
when he found out that
he
you were
get
you
get
and the president were being part of sitting.
And on it went. Dan Rather, you write in your book, the role of the press is to ask hard questions and refuse to be deterred even when someone powerful claims nothing to see here.
Well, I do believe that. and I believe this is an important role of the American press. And what happened on that occasion, for those who are not familiar with it, that I was asking Vice President Bush, who was then a candidate for president, about his role in the Iran-Contra scandal. This was, we sent some of our most advanced weapons to the Ayatollah Khomeini in Iran in a secret deal to get cash from him. But I was seeking to bring out that record. Vice President Bush didn't want to talk about that. That's what this back and forth was about, that he wanted to change the subject. This is the way politicians often handle these things. You start asking questions they don't want to answer. They want to change the subject and make it about you. It goes with the territory. This was a contentious interview, and basically because he had something to hide. Now, for those who hear an echo of that, in the present circumstance, a high-ranking official with something to hide. As it turned out, he had, and I don't like to use the word because I have respect for former President Bush, but he had for quite a long time lied about not having a role in it. That was the core of that conversation. But the larger picture, which you're right to call attention to, and which I do talk about in What Unites Us, is the role of the press, that a free and independent, truly independent, fiercely independent when necessary press is the red-beating heart of freedom and democracy. And if we ever lose that, we aren't going to have the kind of country we have. I think many times, including the present president, political leaders want to convince the public that this is the problem for the press, for those of us who are reporters. But it's a question for the entire country. Do you want a press that will not be intimidated, or do you want a press that can be intimidated by including the power of the presidency?
I've asked this before, and it's certainly been discussed before, going back to the 2016 when Donald Trump was running for president. I can't tell you how many times, the cable news as it is on over your shoulder, on over there, and there was a camera at a podium waiting for the president to come and, or then candidate Donald Trump, come to say something. Was the press, broadly speaking, snookered by Donald Trump?
The short answer and the accurate answer is yes. But snookered might be not quite descriptive, because I think the leaders of the cable networks and others who were doing that, giving Donald Trump unprecedented free time, I think they knew what they're doing. Snookered suggests that they didn't get it. They got it, but they were interested in the ratings. The ratings equal money, so it was a trade-off. But during that period, many in the press, I'm sorry to say, were not meeting their responsibility, because it's one thing to provide the free time for Donald Trump. It's another thing not to ask tough questions and continue asking tough questions. And rather than just being a conveyor belt for the candidate's opinions and in some cases rantings, to perform an editorial, an editing function of, say, listen, we're going to summarize what he says or show you clips. But hour after hour, Donald Trump took advantage of the free time to his advantage to get the nomination and then later to win the presidency, no doubt about it.
Well, there's a question, I think, whether, do you follow the tweets that happen almost every day, or do you wait until something actually happens? And I'm also thinking, especially during the campaign, that Comedy Central, I think, in certain ways, did a better job covering these candidates than the general mainstream media.
In some ways, that's true. I wouldn't say, completely and totally, but, comedy, which has a different value system than journalism, particularly comedy that deals with the irony of politics, as Comedy Central and some others did, is another valuable tool for voters, for news consumers, if you will, to put the news in context and perspective, two of my favorite words, and I've tried to apply them to What Unites Us, to say, look, this is not a screed against Donald Trump. In fact, his name is not even mentioned in the book.
Right.
The goal here was to put forward something that even the most forceful of the Trump supporters could take something away from. But, somehow or another, Artie, we've got to get back to that time and a place where we have a civil conversation with one another. One of the things we're missing now, And one of the hallmarks of the Trump administration has been the incivility. You know, we've never had a president who talked like this president. Let's set aside for his policies, some of his policies, some of the questions he's raising about immigration and taxes. You know, he has things worth considering. But the tone of the presidency is a new low.
Let me quote something else that you say, and then we'll get some callers in on the conversation. You write, simply put, we have more people talking about the news and less original reporting, whether on television or online. There is no shortage of analysis. But I am also thinking about the fact that the New York Times, Washington Post, ProPublica, I'm thinking all, frankly, a lot of the print journalists are doing a lot of really deep investigation.
And this is a good sign. We went through a period where deep digging investigative reporting had gone badly out of fashion. And I wrote during that time, including myself in the criticism, that journalism needed a spine transplant. Well, we've had that spine transplant in a way. There is some really good investigative reporting going on now with some of the outlets you mentioned and others.
Sure.
And this is good not only for journalists and journalism, it's good for the Republic.
That is Dan Rather, our guest in this hour of Radio Times. His book is titled What Unites Us, Reflections on Patriotism. And we've got a couple of callers here at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Let me read an email from Nash. I remember watching Mr. Rather every night with my dad on the news. I follow him on social media and thought his documenting of his road trip with his grandson was awesome, and I know you had a great time with that. Let me get Steve from Newtown to join us. Steve, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yeah, longtime fan, and so glad you're highlighting this normal versus what's abnormal. I had a career in the military, and my final commander-in-chief was Barack Obama, and just, you know, this sitting president not being a citizen, how bizarre, abnormal, or possibly even treasonous. I'm an Eagle Scout, and his speech to the Jamboree was outrageous. But most importantly, this the press being the enemy of the people, talk about abnormal, and now a proven Russian investigation by all our intelligence services, and to have our leadership, this is the most abnormal, and particularly GOP leadership, to have no pushback, that we don't run witch hunts and fake investigations is just the new abnormal.
Well, Steve, you put a bunch of things on the table here. I want to pick up on one of them, the idea of the press being the enemy of the people, which, frankly, President Trump has said, but also Nixon. I mean, he's not the first president, as you write here in your book, Dan Rather, to call out the press.
No, we've never had a president who every day in every way loved the press. However, I think it's important to point out we've never had this situation before or anything near it. You mentioned the Nixon administration. President Nixon didn't like the press. He thought the press hated him. He hated the press. But he used surrogates to attack the press. He did use the power of the presidency to try to attack the press with surrogates. You can't find any place where Richard Nixon used the kind of language enemy of the people. This is a serious accusation to indict an entire profession. What's next, to say that plumbers are enemies of the people, or electricians or architects? I mean, this is dangerous. This is why I say, and I do agree with the caller, this is abnormal in the extreme, to have a president directly attacking individual members of the press and institutions of the press, threatening them with the full power of the American presidency. This is unprecedented. Mm.
What do you make of the White House press briefings? And we've got Sarah Huckabee Sanders essentially running it like a kindergarten, as I see it. You know, they ask their questions, and she has her 7-second or 12-second answer and then moves on from there. What is accomplished?
Not a lot. But what is accomplished, I think, is vital. I agree. I spent 10 years as White House correspondent.
Yes, you did.
Attended those twice-a-day briefings, which were quite different in my day, but that's another subject. Today, the White House press briefings, in some ways, are a theater of the absurd, or, if you prefer the metaphor, kind of a kabuki theater. But I do think it's important that in those moments, They don't happen often. Those moments where an experienced reporter asks a tough question and tries to follow up with a tough question, and to have the public see how the official spokesman for the president responds to that is of some value. Now, I do agree that on some occasions it turns out to be a waste of time.
Yeah.
But I really admire those White House correspondents who day after day try to ask a tough question and try to ask a follow-up question. The earlier press briefings with Mr. Spicer, the predecessor, were more disastrous for the Trump administration. The present press secretary, as you say, she's a woman. She presents a female approach to this. That she's,
it's like unruly children.
She's a mother, yes. And so what she's trying to do is convey the impression that she's a school mom with unruly children. I don't think it's all that effective, quite frankly.
There is a lot of, I mean, you can call it what you want, propaganda. I mean, maybe that's the job of White House press secretary is to not put out propaganda per se, but to put the happiest face on whatever is coming out of the White House.
Well, there are two things in that, and I'm glad you used the word propaganda. That ideally, and we're certainly not dealing with the ideal now, and we rarely have in the past, ideally the White House press secretary, what he or she tries to do is to make it clear to the press and through the press to the public at large what the overall policy goals of the administration are, what the president's thinking, what his mood is at a given time. It has descended in recent years, and now we've reached a new low where it is basically just a propaganda platform. Mm-hmm. It's intended to be by those who have conducting the press briefings, and that's what it turns out to be. And frankly, in this, we won't go too deeply into this, but I'm in favor of teaching school children at about the seventh grade the definition of propaganda, how to recognize propaganda, because we know from our history as recently as the run-up to World War II the dangers of propaganda and its effectiveness.
You were interviewed recently and asked a really interesting question, so I'm going to steal that question and ask it to you again, which is that if you had one question for President Trump, what would it be? What did you say in answer to that question? I know what it is if you don't.
No, I do.
Okay.
No, I do. There's a long list, and I'd be tempted to simply say, show us tax returns. And when he says no, I'm going to follow up. But in answer to your question, what I would say to him is, Mr. President, of what are you afraid? You are obviously afraid of something. What you say, how you say it, and what you do indicates a man who's virtually terrorized within himself. You're hiding something. So why not get out front of it? It's going to come out eventually. So my question would be, of what are you afraid? What deep down, what is it that you're hiding that causes you to say and do these things and indicate that you're in a very fearful position? You're almost terrorized personally. Can you level with me and tell me what that is and at least get out front with it?
I find that so interesting because I think for many people, they see the bluster, the tweets, the taking on of Gold Star families. There's a long list here, and seeing that as not fear but just being a bully. But you're saying, look behind that. What is behind that behavior?
And what is behind that behavior is fear. You don't have to be a psychologist or a psychiatrist. You just have to have been around for a while and know people. And so that would be my question to him. First of all, I think you're more likely to see the Pope ride through this studio on a giraffe than see me interviewing President Trump.
Well, I would like to see both things, the Pope coming in here on a giraffe. That is such a Dan Ratherism. We will get to that later in the hour. Let me read a couple more comments here. What does Mr. Rather think about the point-counterpoint adopted by CNN and other news outlets? And there's nothing really new about that, but you have people that have diametrically opposed opinions, and you let them go at it.
Well, two things about that. First of all, this can lead to false equivalency, that the overall thought between having, three people on one side, three people on the other side, is to reach, quote, balance. And the danger of it is you leave the audience with the idea, well, you know, there are arguments on both sides. Now, it's not true that there are two sides to every story. Sometimes there are two sides, sometimes there are four or five sides. And sometimes the facts dictate that one thing is true. There is such a thing as a fact. We won't get into a discussion of President Trump and his spokesman's efforts to convince us that for every fact is an alternative fact. But let's not get into that for the moment. But that's number one about this business of putting people in the studio, one from one side, one from the other side, is the danger of false equivalency. There was a great deal of it during the presidential campaign. The second thing is to understand that those who put these programs on, we're talking about the large corporations that control so much of our national media distribution, the idea is to make entertainment while calling it news. It's much less expensive to put 12 people in a room shouting at one another than it is to maintain a bureau in Afghanistan or Somalia. So those are the two edges of it. You know, I think people are wising up. I think the news consumer is wising up and recognizes that, well, this is mildly entertaining, but it's not all that informative.
That is Dan Rather, our guest on Radio Times today. His book is What Unites Us, Reflections on Patriotism. He spent many decades at CBS, and he has an independent production company with a terrific name, News and Guts. He's got a big following on Facebook. And we've got a lot of people that want to join our conversation by calling us at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at whyyradio. Times, and do stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoe talking with Dan Rather. Let me play a clip from 60 Minutes, Dan Rather introducing a profile he did on then-businessman Donald Trump, and this is 1999.
If there would be a poster boy to represent America at the turn of the millennium, the celebration of celebrity, the rich almost reeking of prosperity, continuing proof that the American dream exists, then Donald Trump's picture might best fill the frame. His name is on buildings, his face is in magazines and newspapers. Both are on the covers of three previous books, all bestsellers, and now he's coming out with a fourth. But this time, he's not talking only about his prowess to make millions of dollars. Now, he is also talking about his hope to win millions of voters. That's right. New York City developer Donald Trump says he wants to be President of the United States.
That was back in 1999. So were you surprised, Dan Rather, when he came down that escalator 2 years ago to announce his candidacy?
I was not surprised. When he did that piece in 1999, it was clear, and one reason Donald Trump didn't like the piece, and he liked it none, as they would say at home, was he was using an alleged campaign for the presidency to sell a new book, to sell golf club memberships, to sell condominiums. And following around, that became clear. Yeah. But I was not surprised when he came down the escalator in 2015 to say that he was going to run for president. And while I didn't predict that he would win, I did say from the beginning that he should be taken seriously because he could win. And the night before the election, there's nothing to brag about here because I didn't say he would win, but the night before the election, I said on television, while Hillary Clinton has several paths to win, Donald Trump can win. He could win the presidency. So I wasn't all that surprised for the following reasons. Having reported on him over the years, going back to late 70s, at least early 80s, Donald Trump is not dumb. And that doesn't explain why he does such, in my opinion, dumb things. But there's a certain shrewd intelligence that he has. He's smart in a savvy, shrewd way, is that's what I'm saying. And he also understands television. And so knowing that, I said to myself, yeah, he could get the nomination. And after he got the nomination, I said he could win. that he has also he has a sharp instinct for what the public is thinking. I think this is because he spent his life as a salesman, real estate salesman, and you have to read people very well. And some would say give him credit, and I would say give him credit, that he tapped into something. He tapped into fear, the fear of many people in the country that they're going to lose their jobs, the economy's going well, the culture is changing. Frankly, he had a nostril for that in a way that the Democratic candidate did not and the Democratic Party did not, and that was a big key to his getting elected.
When he spoke at his inauguration, he used the words American carnage, not like Ronald Reagan, where he talked about new dawn in America. This was American carnage.
Well, and this gave us, if we needed any, an indication of where he was going to try to take his administration. And it's one reason that I'm optimistic on the medium and long pole. I mean, my view is we're in a fairly dark valley. It may be a long visit. We are going to come out the other end, and I think we'll come out the better for it. But the reason I don't think in the end that Donald Trump is going to be successful as a president, and we've already seen some indications with the election just this last Tuesday, is that successful presidents, almost without exception, give one some sense of nobility. Americans want their leader to be at least striving for that which is noble. It's pretty hard to make a case of any nobility in the Trump administration thus far. Secondarily, successful presidents give people hope. Franklin Roosevelt during the Depression, we have nothing to fear but fear itself. Theodore Roosevelt with all his exuberance as a Republican president. And just go back, and Lincoln, that in the depths of the Civil War, he still, with the power of language, conveyed a message. There's hope. That there's a brighter day coming ahead. You don't see, feel, or hear any of that in the Trump administration. And I think that is the reason he's having so much difficulty, including this recent difficulty at the polls.
Let me read a tweet from Michael. Will Dan Rather acknowledge that journalists are, by and large, incapable of keeping personal bias out of their reporting? And you have often been described as a liberal, you know, that underneath all your journalistic objectivity lived a liberal. Should journalists be completely unbiased, or how have you dealt with that?
Well, first of all, I appreciate the questioner being candid. The answer is no, I don't agree with that. I was raised on the standard American journalism tradition is that one should try very hard to be an honest broker of information. And keep in mind, what is the role of the journalist? Journalists try to establish, to bear witness, to establish facts, to get to the truth, or as close to the truth as humanly possible. Now, while accepting that no person can be completely biased every day on every story in every way, that is the traditional goal of an American journalist. It's one of the roles of journalists. In the so-called straight reporting role, that's a role. Mm-hmm. That's a role I tried to fulfill for overwhelmingly most of my career. As for the charges of being, quote, liberal, unquote, that's among the better things as ever. I've been accused of being a whole lot worse.
I'm sure you have.
But here's the point, that I'm an American. I don't consider myself a conservative, a liberal, a reactionary, a progressive. I care about the country. If you want to ask me about specific issues, I'll tell you what. You know, I'm for a strong military. I'm for clean air and water. I'm for a mixed economy. Those are specific things. But this whole business of the press being, quote, liberally biased, and I individually being so, part of it comes from the fact, and it is a fact, that most reporters have served an apprenticeship in which we see the kind of underside of American life. We see the charity hospital emergency room on a Saturday night. We know what happens at the police station after midnight. That we see poverty at a level that most people have no idea of it. Now, because we see that, and because part of our role is to call attention to it, people don't like the news. It's, well, the problems are not the problem. The people who call attention to the problem, these journalists, are the problem. So somebody always wants to hang a sign around you to diminish you. I've done my best to resist this. I understand if people say, does he have a soft heart for poor people? Guilty as charged. Mm.
Let me read a comment from Chrissy. Thank you, Mr. Rather, for bringing sanity and hope to my news feed. And this is your new venture, News and Guts. I'm going to make a weird segue, but I want to make sure we get this in. We love it when our guests have appeared on The Simpsons. And so we have a clip of you, Dan Rather. This is an upcoming election, and you are interviewing a New Hampshire couple, I should say, on The Simpsons.
As the day of the primary nears, this race is as wide open as a hobo's mouth at a pie-flinging contest. What do you New Hampshireites think of the current crop of presidential candidates?
Well, Mr. Rather, the way I see it, as my father always said, the way I look at it...
Dan, breaking news. Springfield just moved its primary a week ahead of New Hampshire's. Now it's the first one.
Sweet mother of Murrow. We're off to Springfield, people. Come on, folks, move it. Grandma was slow, but she was old. You have no excuse. Into the truck.
To Springfield!
From Springfield!
The one the Simpsons live in.
That's Dan Rather appearing on The Simpsons. I Googled something that I just made up called Dan Ratherisms, and there are a couple of Dan Ratherisms in that clip. Here are a couple of yours. The lead is as thin as turnip soup. The race is hotter than the devil's anvil. In some ways, George Bush's lead is as thin as November ice. I'm flipping through five pages here. The election is closer than Lassie and Timmy. This race is tight like a too small bathing suit on a too long ride home from the beach. This will show you how tight it is. It's spandex tight. Where did these Dan Ratherisms come from, Dan Rather?
Well, I chuckle at some of these myself. Well, from several places. One, I grew up as the son of an oil field pipeline ditch digger, and I did it myself. And working, in manual labor in the heat and soaked in sweat, colorful language was treasured. I grew up around people who talked this way.
Yeah.
Look, you can only say so many times, it's hot as hell today. So the people I work with try to find a new way to say it's hotter than a Laredo parking lot, or it's hotter than a Times Square Rolex. More colorful ways to say things. So I grew up around people who said that. When I started doing ad lib, hour in, hour out, reporting on television and radio, for example, election night, you can only say so many times, this race is close. So I began using, what I thought was colorful language, and it became something of a trademark. I never intended it for to do so. It is true that from time to time, if I hear some colorful language that I think might be appropriate, I write it down in my daily journal and use it. But, with something like 18 hours of election night coverage, there is a danger of being boring, of just same old, same old. So, we try to make it entertaining, at least with a chuckle now and again, and that was the spirit of those sayings.
Near the end of this book, you talk about leaving CBS. You've been there, what, 40?
44 years.
44 years, and would walk across Central Park. I mean, this was your daily commute back and forth between your home and work, and what it was like when you did not do that anymore. You talked about the anger, the sadness, the self-pity, being afraid, frankly.
Yes. Well, look, it's been a long time ago. It's been 12 years since I worked at CBS News. I had 44 years there, and even the worst of it, I have to say I had a great run. I have great respect for CBS News as an institution. This was a difficult time. There are plenty of people who have a lot more problems than I had at that time. A single mom with three kids working two jobs had a whole lot more problems than I had, or the cop walking the beat in a bad neighborhood. But Dan Rather, CBS News, was so much my identity. I made it so much my identity in the nature of what I did that when they kicked me out, which I could come up with a better phrase, but that's basically what they did, not only kicked me out but tried to diminish my work there, it was a bad period. And I did find myself saying, I don't know what I'm going to do. I like to work. I like this work. Now, at that moment, I wasn't sure I'd ever work again in news. As it turned out, fairly quickly, I did find something else. But I put it in the book not because I want to replay what happened at CBS News. We reported a true story. We were attacked because
this is about George Bush.
The process by which we reached the truth, people who didn't want the truth to be noticed changed the subject, and successfully so. But at any rate, having gone through that, I did eventually, and it didn't take very many days, just say to myself, look, there are two ways to do with this. I can at least psychologically get into a fetal position and just say I'm getting the hell kicked out of me and I have to take it, or I can be a get-up fighter, get knocked down, get up, and thanks to Mark Cuban, who hired me almost immediately, it opened up what I think are some of the best professional years of my life.
Oh, that's fascinating. At one point you say your wife would not tolerate any of your self-pity. She basically said, enough of this.
Yes, very quickly so. You know, Gene and I have been, we've known each other 62 years, been married 60 years.
Wow.
And she is a sweet and gentle woman. However, she doesn't truck any self-pity. And she did take that attitude. She said to me, you know, get up, get off your duff, get out the house, find some work. At one point she just said, if nothing else, be a manager at a McDonald's or a Wendy's. But you got to work. You like to work, so go to work.
Well, you do have this company, News and Guts, and you have, I'm not sure how, I mean, you have a huge following on Facebook. Is that a revelation to you?
That's a
maybe even bigger than what you had at CBS.
Well, in some ways, and I love it. I came to it slowly because it's a community, and you get almost instant feedback, and it's more of a conversation. Look, I don't profess to understand it. I am very grateful for it. You know, the longer I go, the more I know of the value of gratitude, modesty, and humility. And I started with Twitter, and now I have my own Facebook page. And also on Facebook, we started a News and Guts Facebook page. Now we're going out on our own, away from Facebook, and have our own internet site, News and Guts Media, and we'll see how that goes. But I'm very grateful for the audience that we've achieved with it. And whatever success it's had, I think it's because of taking the view, we try to give context and perspective and be a steady, reliable voice with some experience.
We're almost out of time here. You're 86.
I am.
Will you work forever?
Well, forever is a long time.
It is. I mean, forever in your life of forever.
Well, as long as I have my health and God's grace, I like to work, and I have a passion for this work. And so it's one sweet step at a time. I'm a lucky man to have seen this day and to be here talking with you. And, you know, my mother had a saying, which was about yesterday, no tears, and about tomorrow, no fears, which was her way of saying deal with today. And as long as I can work, I really do want to work.
Dan Rather, it's been a great pleasure. Thank you so
Thank
much
you.
For joining us today on Radio Times. And again, his book is What Unites Us, Reflections on Patriotism. Go to WHYY.org/Radio Times. You can find out much more about this program. You can download a podcast of the show, find us on Facebook, and follow us on Twitter. We appreciate all those comments to the program as well. And we'll probably be posting some photos of Dan Rather before the show started. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Trine Nuri. I'm Marty Moscoe. Thank you for joining us. Thank you.